So I added some information on final presentations. If you go to the class website and look, hey. Ah, okay. Oh, to see if the Zoom thing works or something else. Gotcha. So I put information on final presentations in the class website, kind of some rough guidance. I had emailed somebody a reasonably good sample presentation already that has a start, you know, a middle, sorry, a beginning, middle, and end, right? You always should have a narrative arc, tell a little story. 15 minutes is not a long presentation. My recommendation is usually about 8 to 10 slides. If they're slides that have pictures and not a lot of words, that can be more like a minute per slide. But the moment you start putting words on a slide or explaining something, it ends up being a couple of minutes, and then you're at 7 slides, right? So try and, you know, keep it somewhere in that neighborhood. I put a sample presentation in and the doodle poll for everybody. And that is only in 2 weeks, right? We only have a couple more weeks here before we're done. Now, I, in principle, put everybody on the last day, even though I think there are 8 people that are actually signed up for the class for credit. So that would put us at running a class for 2 hours and closer to 6:30. Does anybody desperately have to run immediately after class?
No, but Tuesday is senior presentation day.
Mm.
Just throwing that out there. So if you made
Tuesday the 17th?
Yes.
Okay.
So if the next Tuesday could be a couple students,
okay,
that might be nice.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. To try and go to April 24th. Mm-hmm. So I'll see if the room is available. I think that is technically exam week, and room availability is completely weird.
Oh, that's right.
Right?
When are
so.
You
huh?
When are you leaving?
I am leaving on Wednesday the 25th. So we could do it Tuesday the 24th. We could do some at least Tuesday the 24th. Mm-hmm. The other option is if we have to, we can do some way over in another building in Cass. I'm pretty sure that room would be available.
Yes.
But that is relocating people out of this building. I'd rather, you know, if we have enough confusion about just changing rooms, imagine saying, oh, yes, let's all meet at Jefferson Labbing. No, we're across the street. So I'll look into it. That is a fair point. I think there are a lot of seniors in this class. How big are the senior presentations?
There's 13 presenters this year, I believe.
Okay.
I think there'll be more like 10 that actually present.
Oh,
some people
okay.
dropped and or switched.
Switched?
Yeah.
Okay. And that is, so it's still, but those presentations are longer, right?
They're actually shorter.
There's 10 to 15, too.
Oh, 10 to 15, too. Look at that.
I was just hoping to throw it out there maybe for some leniency on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll look into it, right? Certainly, you know, we're not crossing it off the list. I've got it written down. And it's in the audio record, so people know that we discussed it. So I started all of this stuff with synchrotron radiation last week and started talking through things. I would like to get through synchrotron light sources and into collective effects. And the other thing I will try and do is make Tuesday a reasonably, you know, I will not bump student presentations forward into the 17th, knowing that that's senior presentation day and people are liable to be busy with that. So that's perfectly fair. What I posted is I posted a couple of slide decks. Since we're getting closer to the end of the class and I wanted to cover some things, this is material that Bill Barletta, who was the director of the U.S. Particle Accelerator School, gave during my class that I was teaching for him a year and a half ago in January 2015 about synchrotron radiation. This was a 2-week course where we do the entire curriculum in 2 weeks every day. I was due to have a colleague teaching with me. I got there on Sunday, and he never appeared, and I had to teach the entire course 7 hours a day plus homework sessions every night by myself.
Did you have to grade two or
grade? No, I had to grade two.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it was a long 2 weeks because he was my grader along with my co-conspirator.
This is undergrad class, right?
That was an no. This was the graduate level accelerator physics course at USPIS. Yes. Yes. So anyway, enough of that. Enough of my sob story. What I will do is before we go into this, I also wanted to point out I did post homework 5. I tried to print it out, except the place where I was earlier had a busted printer, apparently due to the power outage or something like that. So please go to the website. I will mail everybody a PDF. There are 2 things, a couple of questions that are fun in this homework set. One is a bunch compressor, and it is a relatively simple bunch compressor. You've just got 4 dipoles, no quadrupoles, no bendy things like that. April, can you hear me over there? Good, okay. And I sketch out kind of what the 2x2 matrix for the longitudinal motion now looks like for this sort of thing. It looks like a drift where this M56 acts like, you know, in regular X and X prime or Y and Y prime, this is 1L01, right? So this looks like a drift length. Here, because of relativistic stuff, if this thing is going straight, that thing length compresses down to nothing. And unless you do something fancy like this, you can't make something look like a drift, a longitudinal drift. Oh no! Clearly one of those days.
No, it's up.
I think he was fiddling with the stuff. So the homework is to just do geometry, right? Say that, okay, you know how the bend angle varies with momentum. It kind of varies linearly with momentum. So draw some triangles, draw some similar triangles based on this distance here and assuming that this theta is small. And when you do that, you can kind of figure out, okay, how much shorter is this path than this path for a given variation of momentum? Right? If the momentum is infinitely high, you don't bend in that dipole at all. You go straight. Mm-hmm. Right? If the momentum is infinitely low, of course, you end up, you know, bending horrible, horrible places. But for now, at least, just look at a small change, a small delta, and a small theta, and you can do the geometry and figure out the math and figure out, in fact, exactly what this change in this length is, this change in distance I travel versus a variation of momentum. And it ends up being something nice that goes, interestingly enough, like the angle squared, not like the angle, which is kind of fun. And also because you end up doing this and you end up getting a cosine or a sine term or some trig terms in there, you can actually expand it out in higher orders. And what I ask you to do is also take a look at the higher orders if you get the chance. That's kind of the... But the main thing is figure out the first part, which is for that chicane, what is that effective, you know, that effective drift length, or that M56 we call it. We use this all the time. When you come see CBAF, you might hear one of us say something about, oh, blah, 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 M56, because this is the only way that you can effectively, remember, very relativistic electrons are all moving close to the speed of light. So how do I change their longitudinal distribution? I have to give different momentum guys different path lengths to have them bunch together or spread apart. I can't just send them through, you know, space and wait for them to bunch together or wait for them to spread apart. Everything is way too relativistic for that. So sending things through these little chicanes, and in fact, we have some of those that you might see during the tour at Jefferson Lab. This is exactly how we create this effective bunching for electrons. And I explained some of that in the problem. So that's a little bit of a practical problem. And then there are 2 other homework problems. Just calculate some stuff with synchrotron radiation that I'll go over today using some equations from the slides, and look at the LHC. And the LHC, you're going to hear me say protons don't really synchrotron radiate that much.
well, at very high energy that they do, right, if they're hyper-relativistic, ultra-relativistic. So figure out, you know, for LHC-type energies, how much energy does the proton really radiate in synchrotron radiation. You'll find it's not huge, but it's not tiny either. It's something that people actually had to calculate and worry about, as opposed to smaller proton accelerators where we just never even think about it, because it's literally, you know, 10 to the minus 6th kind of effects on the beam energy. And then do that same kind of calculation for electrons, and you rapidly see that, oh my God, the electron would, you know, crash into the wall after, you know, 1/10 of the way around the LHC, not even go around very much. It would just radiate all of its power away immediately. So for very, very high energy electron accelerators, you always want to create linear accelerators and not bend the particles much if you can help it, because they radiate away that energy really fast. And then a question down here about the conceptual question related to synchrotrons and synchrotron radiation and longitudinal focusing from the last class. So some of this was from a couple classes ago. Some of this was from last class. Some of this is from this class. That's good. That's why it's homework. So take a look at that. It's due next Tuesday. So, but for now, let's go back to these slides from Bill.
Next Tuesday, yeah. Or next Thursday?
Sorry, due next Thursday. Next Thursday. The other Tuesday. And what I'll do is I'll try and download these and put them in full screen so that we have a prettier. There we go. So that's prettier. So you can always get kind of length scales and energy scales interrelated for things like photons and things like light, right? If you know, but just like de Broglie showed, even particles have wavelengths. The de Broglie wavelength is the effective wavelength if you look at a particle in the wave approximation. So starting to look at what kind of frequencies for what wavelengths of light, you back convert, right? Things that are on the order of a micron at least are in the terahertz range, many hundreds of terahertz, with wavelengths like that. But amazingly enough, the photon energies are only, you know, on the order of, gosh, an EV, right? Not MEV, not GEV, not even KEV. This isn't even the ionization energy of a hydrogen atom, right? That's on the order of, you know, many electron volts. So, but these are handy round numbers that give you a feeling for, okay, short wavelengths imply large frequencies, but short wavelengths do not necessarily, for photons at least, imply high energies of those photons. So I talked last time about moving charges, and moving charges, just like moving a current up and down a radio tower or something like that, the electric field is radiating out at the speed of light. So if I move a particle, I have to effectively, what I'm doing is I'm creating a kink in the wavefront. If I move the particle relativistically close to the speed of light, let's say I hop the particle almost immediately at the speed of light, there's a sudden change of where the electric field is coming from. And so there's a discontinuity that happens in the wavefront that propagates out at the speed of light. Now you can take that down a notch and say, okay, I didn't do the unphysical thing of teleporting this charge, but I did move this charge really fast, and that kink now becomes, you know, something more physical. It becomes sharp, but not infinitely large. So I've got, you know, regular old static charge, rest frame of the particle. Whenever I look at the rest frame of a particle, all it's got is electric field if it's charged. And then these magenta lines are wave fronts, right? Constant phase. You can think of it that way. So if I take my particle, but instead now I move into a constant frame where I'm moving relative to the particle, Then what I do is I start compressing some of those electric field lines because I'm moving in that direction. As I'm radiating in that direction, I start expanding the field lines behind them, and then out at the sides, there's kind of this, kind of this compression going on as well. And what happens if you look at the field lines is the field lines start to compress. I start to get kind of a pancake. Oh, look, I got a real board. I don't have to work on the chicken overhead. There you go. So, a regular particle at rest has field lines that are isotropic. A particle that's moving has field lines that end up being kind of compressed, transverse to the direction of motion. And a particle that's really relativistically moving ends up having really, really kind of field lines that are really, really tightly bunched. It almost, people talk about this in terms of a pancake, right? So this is at rest. This is moving, less than c, and this is v approximately c or something like that, right? Very relativistic. And what's happening here is that the field lines are getting bunched in front and expanding out in the back. I've got a wonderful little program that shows some of this stuff because it is going to help connect these things. But let me go to the slide first and explain one other thing that's deep. And that is, as kids, as young physicists, as first-year physicists, you kind of learn about electric and magnetic fields as separate things. And you memorize Biot-Savart, and you memorize Faraday, and you memorize Maxwell's equations and all of this stuff. And fundamentally, electric and magnetic fields are exactly the same thing. And if you start incorporating relativity, everything in its own rest frame has only an electric field. And magnetic fields only exist because of relativistic effects from electric fields being boosted in the airframe. That's all magnetism is. And the classic example, and it's an example I try and teach the 232 kids, and it blows their poor minds, right? Is think of a constant line charge. And this constant line charge is on some insulator, so the charges are just sitting there. And this thing just has an electric field, right? It has no magnetic fields, but has an electric field. And then what you do is you boost. And you can boost, the charges, or you can boost yourself, whichever you like. But then effectively what this thing looks like is a current. And you can derive from relativity the transformation of these electric fields here, which you know from electric field theory, into the standard current-carrying wire stuff. And you can almost derive special relativity from this comparison. There's a deep connection. Poincaré got really close before Einstein got there because those two were so connected. So this is, this magnetic fields only exist because of boost, basically because of boosted electric fields. And that's really, boom, right? I mean, that's like the little kid in the ad. And we think of this, accelerator physicists think of this, because our field is by far the best example of special relativity anybody has ever heard of. We routinely deal with particles that are moving 99.9999995% the speed of light. Not quite routinely, but close to it. And by gosh, special relativity really works well. And it better, because if it didn't, then E&M wouldn't work quite the same way, and your cell phones wouldn't work quite the same way, and dogs and cats would live together, and the world would fall apart. So we've got this thing, right? We've got these particles that are moving and compressing their field lines in front, expanding them in back, pancaking the wave fronts. The field lines end up making a little pancake out to the sides. And you can go through the Lorentz transformation and do all of this stuff if you want. These are those kinks I was talking about, and this is Bill's way of looking at, okay, if I just move this particle over suddenly by, you know, teleporting at little deltas, what happens is the field lines move and change, and at these various wavefronts, I start to see discontinuities in the slope, right, of the electric field. The electric field itself has to stay continuous, but I do get curves, I do get changes, I do get slopes. There is a cool program out there. Let me play with it and see if I can get it to work.
Like Wells?
Yeah, they do a little bit. It's also, you guys are way too young to remember an old video game called Tempest, where you're looking down this long tube and you got, so anyway, yes, they do look like Wells. I completely agree. So, oh no, if wine doesn't work there, how do I do this? Let's see. I've got a program in here called Radiation 2D that actually animates this stuff and lets you play around with it. So let's see. Oh, yeah, okay, so that's fine. Others. Okay. So this was written by a physicist in Japan. Isn't this amazing? I mean, look at that. That's a classic electric field. And you can also plot the wavefronts. Oh, and now that electric field is radiating. Okay. So that's a static particle, which is just boring. All of the wavefronts are radiating out at the speed of light. But let's say, for example, we take that particle and we move it back and forth at, let's say, something like, 0.1 the speed of light. Okay. And what you do is you start to see those, you start to see a wave in the field lines as well. It's not really interesting yet until you start getting up to appreciable parts of the speed of light. Now what happens at about 0.5 the speed of light? Now you can really see that those field lines are gathering in on themselves and those wavefronts are starting to compress a little bit. So let's get even faster. Let's go, you know, this is a particle wiggling around on, for example, a radio tower, radiating out radio waves. And now this really starts to look interesting, right? You can see, if you're standing out here as an observer, what you can see is you can see kind of these wavelengths of the radiation. You know, the wavefronts, there's an increase in the number of field lines, then there's a decrease and an increase and a decrease. You can really see kind of the true wavelength of the radiation versus the distance between the various wavefronts as you go along in there. Now what's also happening in here, if you look closely, at the very ends as this particle accelerates back and forth, you can see these bunched together wavefronts coming out, right, that have quite high density of electric field lines. Well, a high density of electric field lines is high voltage, is high field, is radiating out power. So let's do something like a bending magnet. And let's look at the bending magnet at 9/10 the speed of light. So I've got my particle moving along here, and let's try and run this a little slower and see if we can trajectory of a bending magnet there. Or let's even just pause it somewhere in here. Okay. So what I did is I just paused it, and you can see all the compression in the front wavefronts, right? Particles moving an appreciable rate, you know, compared to the speed of light. So it's catching
all of its radiation up in front, and it's leaving behind these longer spaced wave fronts, which is fine. And you can see also that the field lines really did compress to the sides. So, and this is only, you know, this is only 9/10 the speed of light. If you really, really get up there, and let's do this again and look at something closer to, 0.999 the speed of light, right? And run this a little bit. Man, those field lines are just completely pancaked, right? And what you've got is also, you're practically racing with your own wave fronts. There's no time for those wave fronts to get ahead of you. Except when you turn, and they don't, because they're not charged. So what happens is, once this thing hits a bend, right, I mean, I'm moving along with my own radiation field, essentially, and the moment that I hit a bend and turn, you can think, even classically, you don't need quantum mechanics or anything like this, you can use classical E&M to explain exactly what's happening with that one set, with that radiation, and boom, I turn, the wavefront keeps on going straight. And what happens is, this power radiates out. This power that I was carrying with me. And I leave that, you know, out in front of me. And I have just synchrotron radiated away some of my power. And I move along, and I'm still carrying my wave fronts, and I've still got all of this stuff behind me. But by gosh, you know, there are all these field lines left over. And those field lines are genuinely connected to that wave front. So they're perpendicular to the wave fronts, right? So there's real photons, real power being radiated there, and you can calculate that spectrum, and we'll go through some of that through these slides. Now, that's just one bend, and there's all sorts of fun things you can do. Like, for example, you can, you know, what happens when a particle is moving in a circle, right? Okay, I've got this particle in a circular accelerator, and I'm going through my bend. I'm constantly bending, so I'm constantly blasting out wave fronts as I go around. And somebody out here as an observer can see that wave front hit me once per turn. I can see that synchrotron light, of course. So this is in the very old days, people then looked at this light and said, hey, I can image really small stuff because this light has really short wavelengths. Because if this particle is moving, you know, 0.9995% speed of light, by gosh, those are, you know, the electron was riding on its own wavefront. The characteristic wavelengths are really short. So I can do really nice imaging and interesting imaging. But there's not a whole lot of power there because, by gosh, that electron is just being, you know, all the electrons that are circulating are being indiscriminate and just throwing that power everywhere as they bend through these magnets. So people got smart, and people said, well, okay, that was first generation light sources, it was called, where I just have dipoles, and as the electron is going through this dipole, you know, what I do is I have this energy being thrown out in this kind of fan, and then I make a little hole here, and I have a little observer here, and that little observer sees some of that light coming through that and uses it on samples and tries to, you know, use it to illuminate things and look at stuff. And this is first generation light sources. That is pretty, so one of the problems with it is that, okay, if I've got, I don't have one electron, I have a bunch of electrons. And that bunch of electrons looks like a source for this light. And if that source is kind of big, this light is kind of, you know, fuzzy. It's kind of, you know, I'm imaging a source, and if the source isn't really small and bright, I can't take that light and focus it down and get a nice small, you know, very, very high density of photons to get my good imaging down here. So these were limited by the beam size. Now, one of the great things about synchrotron light that you learn is that, okay, a particle going around one of these things Well, as you'll learn in the homework number three, because I'm radiating power, you look at the picture, I'm radiating away all of that power. Why don't I immediately fall into the center of the accelerator and hit the wall and die? Because I'm radiating away all my power. Well, also what you've got is you've got RF in there that's adding power back to the beam. So you set up your RF so that you catch it with, on average, exactly as much power as you lose to synchrotron radiation. You put it back in the beam. And I ask you to draw the little waveform in that question, to label which one is which, and why this one is stable and that one's unstable, and stuff like that. Okay, that's fine. So I can at least keep my particles in here long enough to have some photon flux. But it's still not a very bright source. The other thing that happens is that, okay, as the particles go around, they're radiating photons in a cone, and we'll learn that that cone has an opening angle that goes like 1 over gamma, which feels really small, which is fine. I mean, gamma is really big, so my cone is really small. But then as I, so this is the radiation, and so this is an energy loss. When I go through the RF, how do I gain energy? I gain energy only along the electric field lines, which are exactly straightforward. So you look at this, and you look at this, and you say, I'm taking away energy like this. I'm giving energy like this. The net effect is that I'm really kind of damping away any transverse energies and trying to make everything as parallel as possible, as straight as possible. So together, what these two do is they damp, transversely damp the beam. They make the beam smaller. Yay, that's exactly what I want for my imaging. Yeah, okay, up to a certain limit. And there's a certain limit because also what's happening in here, remember as I bend, there's also dispersion. And what happens when I radiate is not only do I, okay, when I radiate away some of my energy, you know, that's kind of like radiating away some of my momentum. That's fine. But this dispersion, now I'm on a trajectory that doesn't match my energy because I lost some energy. And the different trajectories, there are different trajectories for different energies because there's dispersion in here. So that adds some excitation, right? At least horizontally. It means that my beam does not get really, really small horizontally because there's also some of this issue going on coupling the dispersion, and we'll go through that in some of the slides.
So is medical imaging harnessing, or well, I guess, recycling the radiation?
Medical imaging is separate than this, okay. For the most part. This, the wavelengths here are way below any biological timescales. Okay, these are material science wavelengths, and looking at molecules. If you're looking at atoms,
so like
you want MRI.
Sort of thing.
Huh?
So like something like this would be more like building material decay.
Something like this is more like we just made a new molecule for a designer drug or a protein, and we want to try and image it.
Okay.
We want to make very, very bright X-rays. You know, and if you do biological imaging with those very, very bright X-rays, you get a very white picture. It's just nothing, you know. There's on the other hand, if you look at very, very small scales, that's when you start to see interesting things. You want to do imaging with the wavelengths that are comparable to the things that you're trying to image or better, right? That's oddly enough, okay, we just talked about de Broglie wavelengths. I'm going to wax, you know, go off script a second. Why is CBAF 12 JeV so special? Why wasn't it 10 JeV, or why wasn't it, you know, 50, or why wasn't it 1 JeV, or why wasn't it 100 JeV? Okay, It turns out that if you figure out the wavelength of these sorts of things, these sorts of electrons have wavelengths that are on the order of something like 0.3-ish Fermi or something like that. They have wavelengths that are a bit smaller, but not tragically smaller than nucleons. Well, what are we trying to do? We're trying to do nuclear physics with this machine. We're trying to image nuclear structures and nucleons within nuclei and protons within that as well. So you need probes that at least have wavelengths of the things that you're trying to identify. Otherwise, you're looking with a really fuzzy lens. And you're looking, it's like looking in a microscope and trying to look at small details. At some point, it all looks fuzzy, right? So back to these guys, you'll find out that the hard X-rays are really kind of the sweet spot for most of the imaging done at light sources. UV as well, but hard X-rays is also good. I just wrote up here one other thing. So this cooling stuff, I said, is limited in the horizontal by the fact that you also have dispersion in places where you're producing the synchrotron radiation. So you're not jumping the particle positions to the proper place when they lose energy. Vertically, though, that doesn't happen. Vertically, there's no dispersion. In principle, you should be able to cool an electron beam down to practically, a point where all of the electrons are exactly the same, going exactly the same way within the limits of the alignment of your RF system. And if you look at a beam like this in kind of Y prime space, okay, well, all of the Y primes are zero and all of the Ys are like this because they're all exactly parallel. Remember what emittance was? Well, emittance is the area of this thing. And if that vertical dimension is zero, this emittance kind of goes to zero, right? You get, ultimately perfectly cold beam. It turns out that, I wrote down QED or something like that. It's not quite all the way to QED. There are quantum reasons. And it does get down to the quantum limit where these electrons cannot occupy the same quantum numbers and end up spreading out and having slightly different momenta. And the momentum spread is determined by quantum packing into that space. So electron beams horizontally, the brightness is determined by dispersion. Vertically, the brightness is determined by quantum effects, which is kind of cool. So this, I said this was first generation. First generation is kind of old, kind of boring. You've got the circulating beam, and it has this equilibrium emittance determined by the balance of this cooling and the dispersion or the quantum stuff. So that's fine. You've got this beam now that is still kind of too big, though, too big for the things you want to do. So the second generation light sources, now I might be writing somebody's presentation for them because somebody might have picked light sources, right? So the second generation light source, let's pull another neat trick. Let's not use one bend. Let's use something like this. So here you run this movie. Okay. And what's happening is you see that there's a little wiggle in there behind these particles, behind the electron that's traveling through the system that wiggles, all of the electric field lines in the tail. You can see all of that behind because everything is stretched out. Up front, though, all of that stuff is compacted together, and that pulls the electron back from the wave front even just a little bit more and lets the wave front now, if this oscillation of the electric of this electron has exactly the right wavelength compared to the synchrotron light it's giving off, what you can do is you can almost even get
lasing. Because now you have a bunch of electrons, and these electrons back here are giving off synchrotron light, and because of these wiggles, they lag a little bit behind their light, or their light gets a little ahead of them. And their light is exactly, and at the next wiggle, that light is on top of these other electrons. And that light interacts with those electrons and says, hey, let's give off some radiation exactly at this frequency. And it's a feedback effect that builds on itself, and builds on itself kind of exponentially. And they give off more photons, and everybody else now has that many more photons, inducing that much more lasing. And this is, in fact, you know, this kind of thing, this wigglers and undulators. There is a technical difference between these two. One of them does kind of look more like this. One of them does look more like what I'm talking about here. Don't worry about the technical differences. But these light sources use kind of, use lasing to get exponentially more power. And because these electrons, you guys know how regular lasers work? Population inversion mean anything to anybody? Uh-oh, okay. I have to explain this because then the next term will make sense. Side comment number two. So this was side number one. You got two sides with your lecture. Choose your two sides. I guess it's these two. That was side number one. This is side number two. Okay. So side number two is that electrons circulate around atoms. Got that? Now what you can do is you can put an electron in an excited state, of course, right? And then as it goes down and drops back, it's going to radiate off a photon. Now what you can do is you can create a population of these atoms. And there are ways to, if you do it carefully and pump the right kind of radiation into them, you can have all of these guys kind of hanging out in an excited state together. This is called population inversion. You know, you could also think of it as priming the pump or lighting, you know, kind of, you're storing a lot of potential energy in fundamentally the lattice of this material, and it's heat often. It could be a gas like xenon, like a noble gas. It could be a solid like ruby. But what you're doing is you're putting a lot of electrons up in the same, and it has to be a special material where the average lifetime in this excited state is pretty long, right? It can't be something where, you know, the thing just decays in a microsecond or something like that. So if you can excite these populations high enough, and then what happens is that one of them gives off a photon, that photon will stimulate emission. It is, you know, quite literally a simple a resonant simple harmonic oscillator. I'm at the right frequency to jiggle this guy exactly at the right frequency to drop and give off another photon, and so on and so forth. And what happens is you get this chain reaction, just like a nuclear bomb, except instead of neutrons, it's photons. And this chain reaction happens to be in such a way that as these photons are passing and stimulate emission of other photons, they're all photons that are in phase. And that's what this is. This is light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. It's in the name. That's what a laser is. And that's what the early solid-state lasers looked like. That was the origination of lasers in the 1960s. Big, big breakthrough. Which is fine, except nobody, you know, those are boring, right? There are diode lasers and stuff like that that people use for fiber communications and all of these things. What the heck does that have to do with this? Well, it turns out that the stimulated emission is doing the exact same thing here, except there are no atoms. It's just electrons. And the electrons aren't bound to any atoms now. So now what you have is you have what's called an FEL, a free electron laser. And you can get huge amplification, you know, as is exemplified by this, you know, wave front, that if that thing hadn't been there, this wave front would be spread out more. There would not be nearly as much concentration of that light, those photons coming off of those wiggling electrons, as there was here. So you can get true lasing in this free electron system. And these, nowadays, these guys, I mean, I mentioned a big accelerator in SLAC, LCLS2, the other day, right? The LINAC coherent light source, which is a free electron laser, and it is, in fact, one of the world's brightest, one of these. And that's why all your buddies that are in material science are all excited about going to California and doing experiments at SLAC, because they are imaging, you know, that this light comes out rapidly enough and at short enough wavelengths that potentially with this type of an accelerator, you can start to take actual movies of atomic level processes and molecular level processes. You can do things like watch proteins fold, which is just blows your mind. You can't do that with any other type of light. But this light is bright enough and coming fast enough that has both the temporal and the spatial resolution to do stuff like that. And that's crazy, right? So oh my God, it's already 5:15. I've been waxing very prosaic. But this is fun, right? I'm about to show you equations. Equations aren't fun. Equations are why, you know, you have to do the homework. Okay, let's figure out, you know, protons. If I got protons doing this, I don't think Shintaki-san put protons in here, which is too bad because, well, not really, because protons would be really, really, really boring. Okay, protons hardly emit any synchrotron radiation. It turns out that what you need is you need particles moving very close to the speed of light, right? Because they have to compress their field lines. Getting protons 0.9995% the speed of light. You can get that in the LHC. You know, getting them really, really close to the speed of light is hard. Otherwise, electrons are a lot easier because they're a lot lower mass. And we'll see in some of the equations I'm about to show you that the classical radius of the particle plays a little role. So are there any questions before I bore you to death for the next 25 minutes with the equations you need for the homework and talk through the slides? Ah, lost your chance. Okay, that's good. Let's move on. So let's talk through the slides, assuming the slides are in there. Nope, that was the wrong one. There we go. Okay, so I just talked through, you know, some of these things, and you saw in the movie exactly how this is happening, what's happening, that the photons, the electric fields, literally do have discontinuities. And both Bill and I really like Shintaki-san's little visualization program. As you can see, all of these pictures came from an earlier version of that program. And now you can see, as you have multiple electrons circulating around, you can have multiple wave fronts, and you can have higher and higher frequencies as things move around. Let's forget about the Larmor stuff. Well, for those of you in EM2, take a quick look, because this is either in your future or it's in your future, potentially in E&M in graduate school, for some of us going to graduate school. Pointing vector is the pointing vector is essentially the direction of electromagnetic energy, right? So that's the definition of the pointing vector. It's the cross between the electric and the magnetic fields, which are always perpendicular, and the wave propagation is always in the third direction. So the pointing vector and the electric and magnetic fields always make a kind of an orthonormal coordinate system. orthogonal coordinate system. It's not normalized because they're different things, they're different units. But in any event, when you calculate the pointing vector, it's power, and it's power delivery. And you can take some approximations from calculating this synchrotron radiation, put them in, and actually get the power delivered by synchrotron radiation. That's all this is doing. And there's the sine squared. This is the thing I was trying to remember last time in class, when you have a particle that is being accelerated in a certain direction, and then you have those power lobes out to either side. Well, if this angle is theta here, okay, this kind of looks like, yes, it's a maximum at 90 degrees and it's zero at 0 and 180, so it kind of looks like sine theta, you might think. No, in fact, it turns out to be sine squared theta, which is good because this thing is rotationally symmetric. And if I go to minus theta, it better look the same, right? So you can almost argue just from the symmetry of the system that thing has to look, has to have an angular variation that goes something like sine squared theta. And then from other units, you can almost figure out the rest except for factors of 2 pi here or there. So here is the radiated power per solid angle, and you can see it has that sine squared theta dependence that we calculated. And if you really want, I mean, there are better equations later on that are simplifications of this. But what you get is you get some conclusions. And as young physicists learn the lesson, right, the equations matter less than the general form of the equations and the primary scalings. Almost all equations are scalings. Almost all equations are this thing is equal to this combination of other things that are all kind of multiplied together. There are relatively few things. There, this thing equals that thing plus that thing. That's algebra and math. That's physics is all scaling stuff. So how does this power scale, this radiated power, with important things that are more physical for the accelerator system? As the particle is going around these circles and radiating out its power, well, we just saw the distribution, at least per solid angle, goes like sine squared of theta. That's one scaling, but the other scalings that you see are interesting, right? It goes like beta gamma to the fourth. And if you remember lesson, when I teach relativity, one of the first lessons is anything that looks like scaling with gamma is energy, because E equals gamma mc squared. Anything that looks like beta gamma is momentum, because P equals beta gamma mc, right? So this is scaling with momentum to the fourth. People say, okay, a very high energy is momentum and energy. They're basically the same thing. And you'll see that even Bill probably says it scales like energy to the fourth. It's really momentum to the fourth. But that's fine, okay? And it scales with the radius of curvature squared. So the tighter the curve, the more power it puts out. No surprising, right? I'm turning away from my wavefront faster. I'm creating a sharper edge in that distribution. And disconnecting that edge from my field and sending it off, I mean, that takes power away from me. So there is a little bit of a QED approach. You can argue through it. You don't need to. In EM2 or in graduate EM, you will calculate all of this stuff from first principles and realize that Maxwell could have done this had he had some idea about things like relativity. Right? Poincaré could have done this because Poincaré did kind of know relationships between Maxwell's equations that were, for the most part, relativistically invariant. And then Einstein certainly could have done it. So you get the scaling, goes like energy to the fourth over rho squared. That means, or momentum to the fourth over rho squared. But there's also a charge in there, right? So certainly the charge of the particle comes into this radiated power as well. And the key thing in here that helps save you for, you know, electrons versus protons is that beta gamma, right? For electrons, gamma is really high because their mass is low. And beta is pretty much one. For protons, okay, beta is maybe a slight bit different, but the gamma is way down. The gamma is a factor of 2,000 down. And to the fourth power, okay, 2, 4, 8, 16, you know, 30, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, there you go, right? So 1.6 times 10 to the 12th is the difference in power between protons and electrons at the same energy bending through the same radius. No wonder nobody cares about synchrotron radiation for protons. So you can see all of that kind of in there already, but then Bill goes through the math. What you can do is you can say I'm bending around 2 pi of dipoles every time I go around my accelerator. So now I can figure out, okay, as I go around my accelerator, I can integrate that power and get now an energy lost per revolution around the accelerator, or per turn, it's called. And you can box that equation and use that in homework 2, I think it is. So for a constant radius r, here's how everything scales. It's gamma to the fourth again. This is scaling not with rho squared, but with rho, because it's energy lost per turn. It's not power. Okay. But other than that, you know, it's got basically all of the same scalings that you had seen before. So you'll basically just be calculating gamma for protons and for electrons in the LHC, plugging it into this equation and using the rho that I gave you, or figuring out the rho, and going from there. But energy to the fourth, or momentum to the fourth, divided by gamma is the energy loss per turn. Big deal, right? Here are nice, simple equations that you can use. Oh my gosh, you don't even need to calculate out gamma now, because this is energy in GeV. For electrons. So Bill even did most of the relativistic stuff for you and put it in the number in front. And you can just take the electron number in GeV and the radius in meters, plug it in there, and get that this thing is okay. If these things are TeV scale, which is in the LHC, okay, that's thousands of GeV. Gosh, that, you know, so that's 10 to the 12th right there. 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 13th, 10 to the 14th, you know, maybe 10 to the 11th KeV. Oh, no way. You know, you can't get electrons very far in that machine at all. On the other hand, if you do all of that math in protons, you get this nice little equation, which is much, much more reasonable. You're losing kilo electron volts for TeV type beams, or even less, right? So that's not bad. So this gives you a feeling for the scalings, but they're really, you know, it's really shocking. You don't see that many things that scale with, like, energy to the fourth. This is one of them, and it is a big number. Also, you would think that maybe heavy ions or something like that, something with a lot of charge, would have worse things because it scales with charge squared. But those things, you're not accelerating the very high gammas because they're big bowling balls. And so the gammas are really small, and the gamma factor wins over the charge completely. The only stuff you care about is leptons with synchrotron radiation. If there were charge particles that were even lighter, maybe they'd disappear in a puff of synchrotron radiation. So as we take the particle up and up to infinitely high, kind of ultra-relativistic, very near the speed of light, that wavefront now radiates out at the speed of light, but it's kind of comparable to the time it takes the particle to go around the accelerator. So what you get is you get this wavefront that looks like a spiral in space spiraling outward, and it has this cone, that little cone in there. You can figure out what the angle of acceptance is if you're just sitting somewhere watching this thing sweep by and then sweep by again and sweep by again. Just how fast that comes past you. And that compression, that comparison of that time, that length versus that kind of thickness or time it takes the wavefront to pass you goes like 1 over gamma. You can figure that out. It's kind of a fairly straightforward or simple length contraction. And then he gets into frequency things. Now, I'll skip past some of the frequency things a little bit to get to... I didn't ask this question in the homework, but it's worth bringing up because it is something that these customers care about. Right? These customers care about not getting lots and lots of x-rays, but what is the spectrum of those x-rays? Because if they're very, very sharp, then that's great. I can image things with very clear precision because all of the photons are the same wavelength. On the other hand, if all of the photons are all kinds of wavelengths and it's non-monochromatic light, well, my imaging contraption trying to look at those things is going to bend them differently. You get chromaticity, just like you get in real optics. Greens and blues and reds bend slightly differently, and your resolution of your imaging is not nearly as good as it could be. And unfortunately, you know, for classic, this type of old-fashioned synchrotron light, the spectrum of these photons is kind of bad, right? That's that picture. It's a really, really broad spectrum. There's kind of a cutoff where 50% of the photons are above and 50% of the photons are below some particular energy or some particular frequency. That's called the critical photon energy in this parlance of these synchrotron light things. But you can see that distribution there, even if it's on the logarithmic scale, it's not at all sharply peaked. It's, you know, almost an order of magnitude of photons that are basically of the same flux. So what can you do? Well, this helps you tremendously. That was the real breakthrough in free electron lasers, not just the intensity from the lasing, but the fact that it was true lasing. These are fundamentally monochromatic things. There are good reasons why you also use this, right? If I'm looking at a system and it's a big molecule that has many, many modes to it, and I look at it with exactly one frequency, all I'm seeing is that thing at one frequency. Okay. That may or may not be exactly the frequency I want to look at, particularly if I'm looking at some resonant mode of that molecule somehow. On the other hand, if I've got tons of photons that are spread out over many different frequencies, now I can get a much kind of a color image rather than a black and white image through exactly one filter. And both of those complement each other, right? The lasers with their very, very narrow photon distributions and these old-style imaging systems, the first-generation machines, or the undulators. The undulators give that kind of a distribution as well. Both of those are still very, very much in use nowadays. Let's see. So, yeah, Bill even has, I think, some of the numbers. So this is almost the answer. You can double-check your answer for the homework question about the LHC, since the LHC protons are in this column here, and you can see that the synchrotron radiation power is 7 kilowatts. It's not a lot, but it's not a tiny bit either. So let's see. I think I got through fundamentally everything I needed to get through in this to get you to the to get you through the homework, and we're just about at that time anyway. So I think I'll pause here. Oh, I did want. There's always one other thing, right? So I mentioned LCLS2. Turns out that LCLS2 is not, in fact, it is a free electron laser. It is not a second generation light source. It is a third generation light source. What's the fundamental difference between the two? I'm glad you asked. Okay. The second generation light sources are all still rings. And I circulate the particles around in this ring. They're in this equilibrium emittance. I got this equilibrium distribution here, but now I'm lasing.
And so I'm producing this nice monochromatic light, but the beam is still whatever size it is, limited by being in a ring, this equilibrium, this equilibrium emittance. A third generation light source has a LINAC instead that drives a wiggler or an undulator. And that makes the, so why is that third generation? Well, okay, I'm not storing beam in a ring anymore. I'm producing it all the time. And there are new electron sources, little cathodes, where I can shine a really small, very focused laser beam onto the cathode and knock off a little beam of really cold electrons. So cold that their emittance is smaller than the equilibrium emittance of these photons stored in rings. So now I have a linear accelerator which has smaller beam emittance than this light source in a ring, and I get better beam, right? I get better photons coming out from my various experiments. Now the only problem is, okay, in a ring, I can have, you know, experiments, I can have a bunch of different experiments at different places with separate wigglers all, you know, pointing to those experiments. I can serve a big user community. With LINAC, you can go through maybe, you know, switch your beam through a couple of these and have a couple of experiments going at a time, but it's not like you're reusing that electron beam after it goes through this. That also gives you an advantage because third generation light sources, since they're never reusing that beam anyway, they can do horrible, evil things to that beam. They can put it through a lasing system that's really long until the beam shreds itself apart in its own electromagnetic field. And then use those photons and just dump that poor used electron beam to the curb or something like that. So this is the current generation of light sources right now. And there's even talk about a fourth generation of light sources that would combine kind of the best of both worlds, and that is use a LINAC that recirculates the beam for lower power. But as it recirculates, it kind of goes through a system that looks like, you know, arcs where you can service a bunch of users together. So you can kind of get the best of both worlds. The best imaging, but lower power cost and more users, and that makes everybody really happy. That's where I'll stop. And I have no idea how I'm going to capture that board in the slides, but we'll see. I'll take a picture and we'll go from there. Tell your buddies, tell your pals, the homework is posted. I will mail everybody and tell them that it is posted. And then we will go from there. And I will see you on Tuesday.